This episode is brought to you by KJK. Tired of the billable hour? KJK has a solution. The KJK GC Advantage program offers businesses comprehensive legal services in the areas of employment, corporate services, real estate, trademark, intellectual property, and estate planning, all for a set monthly fee. KJK serves as their clients' partners in business, not just their lawyers. Along with cost certainty and predictability, the KJK GC Advantage program gives clients peace of mind, knowing their projects will be handled quickly and efficiently, maximizing the return on investment on their legal spend. So don't go it alone. Let KJK help. Learn more by visiting kjk.com. Startups Nation, welcome to another episode of the 614 Startups Podcast. I am your host, Elio Harmon, and I have a very special guest. I know I say that a lot, man, but this one is very special. I have been following this man from the very beginning. I think it was a TED Talk that got me hooked on his content. But join me in welcoming my very special guest, my man, Kwame Christian of American Negotiation Institute. Kwame, welcome to the show.
Elio, thank you so much. And it has been, what, 30 seconds? And now I've learned what energy I need to bring to my next podcast introduction. So I appreciate that, man.
Yeah, man. 5 years in the making, trying to perfect that intro. And I appreciate the compliment on that, man. But that's what this show is about, man. It's about creating engaging content that's beneficial to the startup community here in Columbus, Ohio. It's a long time coming. You know, I follow your content online. It's kind of surprising that 5 years later, this is our first conversation. But I am equally curious as I ask you this question. Who is Kwame Christian and how did you come to live in Columbus, Ohio?
That's a great question, man. So I'm a lawyer by trade, but I'm also the CEO of the American Negotiation Institute. We conduct negotiation and conflict resolution trainings. I also have a podcast, Negotiate Anything. And how I ended up in Columbus was how a lot of people end up in Columbus. It's Ohio State, the Ohio State University, of course. And so I grew up in Tiffin, Ohio, moved to Columbus for school, stayed in, got my law degree, Master of Public Policy, met my wife. We got married on graduation day, and we've been rooted here ever since.
All right, man. So Tiffin, Ohio upbringing. What was it like growing up in Tiffin? And I'm sure, you know, as you're narrowing down that college list, Ohio State is usually at the top of the list, right? Talking about small town Ohio. But what was it like growing up in Tiffin?
You know, it is interesting. It's an experience that I appreciate more as I get older. And so for me, growing up in Tiffin, Ohio, as a black man, a black male, growing up in Tiffin, Ohio, there were challenges because most people did not look like me. My family's from the Caribbean originally. And so when I was younger, I had a stronger accent. And so now after years of code switching, this is my business American voice, right? And so you stood out. We all stood out. And so that's always tough because you're trying to fit in. But I think what's really interesting, Elio, is like now, after growing up in that type of environment, and now coming with my second book, How to Have Difficult Conversations About Race, it was like the perfect upbringing for me as it relates to bringing a voice to this conversation. So now we have the negotiation and conflict resolution, that competency, like the skill of how to talk about race. But then you also have somebody who grew up as a black immigrant in an all-white city, right? And so I can speak to the black experience, the experience of a person of color growing up in the United States. But I also can understand really well the white experience as well, you know? So it's been really cool growing in appreciation of that upbringing because it's made me really empathetic to everybody when it comes to these difficult conversations. And it helps me to convey the message in a way that's palatable for everybody.
Yeah, I'm an immigrant as well. I was born in Liberia, West Africa, immigrated to the States when I was 12 years old. This is my code switching voice. I go back to my Liberian accent when I'm with my family. But I had to code switch because when I came from Liberia with that Liberian accent, even though I spoke perfect English, I went to a predominantly all black school and I still faced the issue of being different and having to navigate that whole process of assimilating into a society. Let me ask you this. This is going back then. You're a writer about negotiation and conflict and race. Do you feel like that interest was born out of that experience? Did that inform, you know, your early years? Did that kind of inform why you wanted to do this work?
So I would say that it had an impact, but it wasn't the catalyst that took me to this place. But I will say that it created a great foundation for me as somebody who is culturally fluid, who can speak essentially different languages, like you talked about with code switching. And so the thing that actually led me to conflict resolution and negotiation was the fact that I knew I was a people pleaser, and I knew exactly where this came from. So in first grade, I remember there was a time where, just like any other kid, I was looking for somebody to play with on the playground. And I went to one group of friends and asked, hey, can I play with you? And they said, no. Went to another group. Can I play with you? They said, no. And then I went to another group. They said, no, too. And then before I knew it, recess was over and nobody would play with me. And so I tried to keep it together as much as I could. But then when I went in, I talked to my teacher, I just burst out crying. And she's like, what happened? It's like, nobody would play with me. And so from that day on, I said, listen, this is never going to happen to me again. Never going to happen to me again. People are going to like me. I'm going to have a lot of friends, and I'm going to make sure of that. And so I think you could look at it and say, well, yeah, you became like the most popular kid in school. You're always very popular, right? But it came with a cost. I just became terrified of doing anything or saying anything that could rock the boat. So I became a people pleaser because I worked really, really hard to establish these relationships, and I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize it. And so when I got to law school, I discovered negotiation and conflict resolution. And it was the first time I realized that this was a skill, not a talent. Like, I can actually get better at it. It was really empowering. So we had negotiation competitions at the law school. My partner and I, we won the competition at the law school, represented the school at the American Bar Association regional competitions in Canada. We won that one as well. And then we made it to the semis of nationals in Louisiana. And so I was hooked. And so for me, every time I step up and have these difficult conversations and negotiate, it's like, it's just reaffirming that empowering feeling. So I wanted to make sure that my career involved negotiation, but more than anything, I wanted to make sure that I was able to teach people how to negotiate. And for me, there was nothing that existed that did that. And so I had to create it, the American Negotiation Institute. So our motto is, we believe the best things in life are on the other side of difficult conversations. And so what we do is we want to help empower people, as many people as we can, to have these difficult conversations.
Yeah, and a little bit of serendipity there, because your intention of becoming a lawyer was not to become a master negotiator, right? So why were you interested in law in the first place? Going to a school the size of Ohio State with an almost infinite number of career paths or academic paths you could choose, why law?
Yeah, okay. So this is a funny story. So my undergrad degree is in psychology. I wanted to help people. And then I said, you know what? If I get into politics, I could help more people through policy change. That's just more efficient. So that's when I decided to get my law degree and get a master of public policy. The goal wasn't to become a practicing lawyer for an infinite amount of time. It was to have the credibility, check those boxes, law degree, public policy. That looks like a public servant. But I learned something really interesting and important when I was in law school. And it was that I did not want to be a politician. The more I learned about politics, the more I said, this is not for me. I am not going to do this. I'm not going to sell my soul in this way. And I'm not going to do that to my family. I saw how hard that was on families, just the running for politics. And so I was that person at 24 being sworn in, asking myself, what do I want to be when I grow up? You know, and so, yeah, the law degree was almost accidental, but I think it served a really great purpose because it gave me the credibility to be heard as an expert in the industry.
Yeah. And so, I mean, politics is in my blood. My dad is a politician. My grandfather is a politician. You know, it goes back. So I feel the tug of politics. I think that the important thing that you made mention of is that politics continues to be what it is because good people want nothing to do with it, right? And I'm not saying politicians are all bad, but I mean, just like how other fields would want to attract the most talented. But when people realize what that field turns you into, they kind of shy away with it. And so I want kind of the audience, you know, hopefully you voted. This podcast is going to have come out after the November midterm elections. But even if you aren't actively participating in politics as a candidate, it's very important to do your duty as a citizen. Do not allow the game of politics to turn you off of your civic duty. That is a PSA from 614 Startups. All right. On the path of becoming a lawyer, though, one of the dreams of an attorney is making partner within a prestigious firm. Why did you choose, after you became a lawyer, to go the entrepreneurial route? What prompted you to want to start the American Negotiation Institute?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I dabbled in the prestigious route. And so when I had a great summer associate position at a law firm, a big law firm here in Columbus, and it went really well. Still have great relationships from there. And then the next year I was in-house at a Fortune like 20 company, and great relationships, enjoyed my time there, but I knew it wasn't for me. I knew it would be really just about the, like, collecting the money. But I was confident in my ability to create something that was sustainable, but I wanted to make sure that I could get there in a way that was true to who I was. And so I wanted to get my first position out of school. I wanted to get something that spoke to my values, but at the same time gave me flexibility to be creative and figure out what the next step was. So instead of going the traditional corporate type of route, I did public service type of work. And so I worked with the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. And so I did public policy work focusing on health equity. And so I was focusing on infant mortality, health disparities, and traveling the country talking about how we can address those issues, but more specifically, how we could create persuasive arguments in those fields to help to create positive change. And it's from there that I decided to make the leap to start my own thing.
Yeah. So are you telling me that altruism isn't the reason that persuades people to do things that are right, right? You have to give them a persuasive argument. All right. So for all of you folks out there in the nonprofit world, this is not just for founders running for-profit businesses, okay? If you want to do good things in this world, you're going to need this skill of negotiation. And that's where I want to pivot, all right? Because we don't want any misunderstanding of terms here. So let's just get right to the core. What is negotiation?
Yes, I love this question. I ask this question at the beginning of every single presentation. And one time when I was in New York talking to real estate agents, we spent an hour on a slide that just said, what is negotiation? Just talking about it, right? So I like simple definitions. With everything that I do, I want it to be really easy to understand. And my definition for negotiation is anytime you're in a conversation and somebody in the conversation wants something, that's a negotiation. And so you're constantly negotiating. And one of the biggest mistakes people make in their negotiations is that they don't understand when a negotiation is happening. They have low negotiation awareness, right? So if you're talking to your spouse or your kids, those are negotiations too. When you're talking to people on your team, those are negotiations. The problem is we always think about negotiations as these big conversations that are super transactional that happen relatively infrequently. But if we start to identify everything as a negotiation, then it helps us to be more intentional about the way that we interact with people. Because negotiation isn't just about value claiming and getting as much for you as you want for yourself. Effective negotiation has to consider the other person. You have to be empathetic. You have to understand what they want and why they want it. And then you also have to focus on the relationship. So for me, I don't think about negotiation as a skill, even though it is a skill. I don't think about it as a process, even though it is a process. I think about negotiation as a life philosophy, and I filter every interaction through that philosophy.
Yeah. And so you study psychology. Skill, yes, but the psychological component, and maybe if I could challenge you to go even deeper, the biological component of why we tend to not be naturally geared to be effective negotiators. What have you found in your research?
Oh, we're going to have some fun here, Elio. All right, check this out. So when you think back to early humans, we were tribal in nature. We had to be part of the tribe in order to survive. If we were separated from the tribe, most likely that means we're going to die out in the wilderness. alone, right? And so when you think about the early humans who survived, those are the people who are going to be very focused on the community, who are going to be very sensitive to social rejection. Because back in the old days, at that time, social rejection really meant death. If I'm out of the tribe, I'm dead, right? And so when you think about rejection and what that feels as an emotion, it's really powerful, you know, because here's an example of how real this power is. So what they found is in one study, if you put somebody in a position where they are rejected, getting an analgesic, like a painkiller, actually diminishes the amount of pain they feel. Like rejection actually reverberates through our body, like true pain, right? And so a lot of times when you think about how people are conflict averse and afraid of negotiation, they're not necessarily afraid of negotiation. They're afraid of the prospect of rejection. And so in many ways, we're fighting our biology. We're fighting our psychology. We're fighting the natural inclination in order to negotiate and effectively resolve conflict. And so that's why with my first book, Finding Confidence in Conflict, people are really surprised when they start to read it, because about 70-80% of it is focused on the internal side, right? Because for me, it doesn't make sense to give recipes to people who are afraid to get in the kitchen. If you want negotiation strategy, you can just Google that. There are tons of articles on how to negotiate. That's not the problem. Understanding what to do is not the problem. What's the problem is what is inside. And if you don't understand what your own personal psychological and emotional barriers are to having these difficult conversations, you're not going to have them, and you're not going to have them effectively.
Now, before we get into talking about, because you know what the automatic reaction of the audience is, and I almost fell into it. Okay, so how do I get better at negotiation? And you just told me that like 70% of it is the inner game. But before we get into the inner game of it, I want to ask, like, there's a cost, right? So humans, you know, psychology again, need incentives, right? What is the cost to not doing anything? Because you could be so paralyzed by the fear that you just perpetually stay in this state of avoidance, right? You don't want to get better internally. You don't want to focus on the skills because it feels too daunting. What is the cost of not addressing this issue, both personally and professionally?
So let me tell you what the standard negotiation expert response will be. Well, the cost is that you are living a life where you're not living your full potential. Because when you think about negotiation, let's use in a salary context, people who choose not to negotiate are leaving upwards of $1 million on the table over the course of their career. Numerous studies have showed that. When you think about the cost of not advocating for yourself, you're putting yourself in a position where life is happening to you. Things are happening. You're not having an impact on the world. Those are factual things. But for me, the real cost is when you look at yourself in the mirror, you don't respect yourself in the same way. When you look at yourself in the mirror, you know that there is more to life, but you don't fully know what that could be. And the fact that you know you're missing out on that, and the unknown, you don't even know how good life could be. Like, that's the true cost. And for me, I think it's okay to be afraid. I think fear plays an important role. But one of the things we have to do is we have to focus the fear. We have to change the fear. If you're going to be afraid, but you have to be afraid of the right thing. And so for me, I shifted it from the fear of failure and the fear of rejection to the fear of regret. I have to have a longer term perspective. So if I look back on this incident and I don't stand up for myself, will I respect the decision that I made not to step up? And like, that fear of regret is a horrible feeling, because with regret, that means that an opportunity has gone by and you at this moment don't have any, there's nothing that you can do to go back and get that moment back. And so I say, this is my only opportunity to step up. So win, lose, or draw, I want to make a decision today that I'll respect in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, I resonate with the people pleasing side of it. Right. And, you know, in many ways, that is the inner game that I am working on constantly. Right. And really trying to not only address the manifestations of it, but what is at the root of it. That's another episode for me and my therapist, okay? We're working on that together, all right? Let's do something here that you and I maybe can get accomplished over a podcast, which is mostly external, the actual skills that we could read in your book and get better at. But before we do that, folks, that was just a little bit of a teaser. We got to take a break and hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back. Support for the 614 Startups Podcast comes from Nationwide. Nationwide's mission is to protect people, businesses, and futures with extraordinary care. To help fulfill that mission, Nationwide is looking to invest its $350 million venture capital investment fund in InsurTechs that will help them create new and exciting products and solutions to meet the needs of their customers. If you're interested in partnering with Nationwide's venture capital team, visit nationwideventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is nationwideventures.com. Nationwide is on your side. This episode is brought to you by Rev1. Rev1's mission is to help entrepreneurs build great companies. As you navigate the waters of business entrepreneurship, you don't have to go it alone. A strategic partnership with Rev1 connects innovators to the talent, customers, space, and funding you need when you need it. Get started with Rev1 Startup Studio by visiting rev1ventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is rev1ventures.com. 614 Startups Nation, thank you so much for hanging in there. I'm back with my very special guest, Kwame Christian of the American Negotiation Institute. And next up, we are going to talk about the skills. How do you get better at this negotiation thing? All right, Kwame, let's get right into it. What are the foundational skills, the basics, the building blocks of negotiation? What are they?
So here's what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you my framework that I brought to the table called the Compassionate Curiosity Framework. And so it is very, very simple. And it took me years to get it this simple, because my goal is to make sure that everything that I give you and your listeners today is practical. I want you to be able to listen to it, learn from it, immediately put it into action. So it's a three-step process. Number one, acknowledge and validate emotions. Number two, get curious with compassion. And number three, joint problem solving. And it allows you to understand what to say and when to say it for maximum impact. It addresses the emotional component and gives you a system for that. But the thing that I like the most about it is that it was designed for not only the external negotiation, but also the internal negotiation as a tool of introspection, emotional regulation, and bias reduction too. So internally, again, we're going to acknowledge our own biases, our beliefs, our conclusions, our feelings. We're going to acknowledge those. And then we're going to get curious with self-directed compassion, because a lot of times our own internal voice is our own worst critic, and it can be really harsh. And if it's too harsh, then we stop this introspective process. And then lastly, when we're reconciling the differences between our hearts and minds, so that's what's happening in joint problem solving, step number three, internally. So what is it that would satisfy me emotionally in this situation? And then what should I actually do and say in this moment? And so as you go through that, it gives you clarity, helps you regulate your emotions, and identify any problems with reasoning and decision-making too. So with this, and listen, I'm going to throw this up to you too. If you want to, we could do a role play to show what this actually looks like in action, because I think that's one of the best ways. But it's really, really flexible. And I use it for me as a lawyer, if I'm negotiating deals, if I'm negotiating with my wife or my 7-year-old, which happens constantly, and when I'm talking to my staff. I want it to be something that is ubiquitous and can be used in any situation.
All right. So I'm willing to be vulnerable, but I want to be vulnerable with you in a different setting. Okay. I think we need to set aside this negotiation thing. And maybe we have an audience, right? Maybe we have people who participate with us. Maybe we do a B-School episode. These are episodes that we're now doing with experts that come on in a virtual setting and do a mini course, right? Where we have people in the audience and people can engage. So I'm definitely going to add you to the list of folks we're going to have on. All right. So I want to dig into, you called it the compassionate curiosity model. And number one is to acknowledge the other person's feelings and also acknowledging your feelings. But yes. I find it very difficult in my personal life to do that, especially when the stakes are high, because I automatically retreat to my a front line, my defensive line, right? And I feel this rush of chemicals, right? Now, I'm not thinking. Frontal lobe is off. You know, it's fight or flight, right? But I'm going to stand here. I'm going to fight. But my frontal lobe is off. How do we become aware enough to say, oh, wait a minute, a negotiation has started. Let me not do what I normally do. And let me focus on this feeling acknowledgement. What do you teach your clients to do if they have a habit of that retreat and putting up a wall and starting from there in terms of a negotiation?
Oh, this is good. Well, listen, man, when you start talking about lobes, that's when I start to get excited. All right. So let's talk about this. When we're emotional, we are going to be activating the amygdala. But the best version of ourselves, like the highest level of thinking, logical reasoning, executive function, that's located in the frontal lobe, like you said. But there's an antagonistic relationship between those brain structures. So the more emotional I am, the less clearly I'm thinking. And the more clearly I'm thinking, the less emotional I am. It's an either or proposition. And so we have to remember that it doesn't make sense to send a message to a person who is not psychologically ready to receive it. And at the same time, we have to be self-aware enough to recognize, hey, I'm not in my best emotional state. I need to slow things down. And so I'll defer to the wisdom of Bruce Lee, who said, I don't fear the man who knows 1,000 kicks. I fear the man who has practiced one kick 1,000 times. So one of the things I love to do is, as people try to complicate things, I just tell them, listen, you just need one technique. Just use this as the conversational baseline, right? So like you said, we have these conversational habits. So we need to be very intentional about replacing those conversational habits with this new habit of compassionate curiosity. And so for me, the more emotional I get, the more closely I hold on to the framework. I don't need to freestyle. I don't need to try something new. It works. And here's why it works scientifically. So when we are acknowledging and validating the emotions, what we're doing is we are labeling the emotion. We're giving an emotional label to it. And the reason this works is when you label an emotion to the other person, what they have to do is they need to determine whether or not they accept or reject that emotion. The part of the brain that does that is actually located in a part of the frontal lobe. So it activates the frontal lobe, which quiets the amygdala. So I'm going to say something like, it sounds like, it seems like, or I can tell that if it's very obvious. So if we're having a conversation, Elio, and I can tell that you're getting a little bit heated about the situation, I'm going to slow things down. Okay, compassionate curiosity. I know what to do. All right, so correct me if I'm wrong, Elio, but it seems like the situation is really frustrating for you. Am I reading that right? And then I'm going to give you the space to vent, decompress. And I'm not going to contend. I'm not going to argue. I'm going to empathize. I'll say, okay, now correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like you're saying X, Y, Z, right? I'm going to summarize it. And then I'm going to say, listen, that makes sense. I can understand why you feel that way, given your perspective and your situation, right? And I'm going to cycle through that until I recognize the emotional temperature in the room has gone down to a point where we've reached a point of stability. And now I can transition to step two, which is getting curious with compassion, asking those open-ended questions. But it goes back to that word you said, is that habit. Got to build that habit.
Yeah. Now, Bruce Lee, all-time great, one of my favorite, classic old-school kung fu movie lover here, okay? But the thing about the guy who knows 1,000 kicks is every kick feels different. The guy who only practices one kick, that kick feels the same. So how do you truly, right? Because most of communication is not verbal.
Yep.
How do you truly communicate fully that this is not a dress rehearsal? Because it can feel like, oh, he knows negotiation. He's negotiating right now. So how do you take yourself out of this rehearsed thing? Because especially with a spouse, right? You have to be mindful that an acknowledgement of feeling is a real acknowledgement of feeling and not becoming routine, because a person across from the table can sense genuine interest in my feeling and not just a tactic. How do you manage through that without that becoming a routine that you just do because you know that's what you need to do?
Great question, man. And it has to be authentic. That's the key. And one of the things I always tell people is I don't want people to become a negotiator who negotiates like Kwame Christian. I want you to become a better version of yourself. So when I use compassionate curiosity, it'll sound different from the way that you use compassionate curiosity. And we have to find our voice in this, especially if we're not used to empathizing. Empathy is a skill, and a lot of times we just don't practice it, right? And so we have to find our voice in it. That's the first thing. But more so than anything else, we have to legitimately care. We have to legitimately care. Because if we don't care, then it will be nothing more than a tactic. And you cannot be authentic in empathizing if you don't care, right? So that mindset is critically important. And I'll tell you, like, it's not easy. It's not easy. So you think about StrengthsFinder, how they rank your strengths from 1 to 34. For me, and this surprised like all of my friends, number 34 for me was empathy. Number 34 was empathy. And because it makes you answer quickly, I'm not thinking through it. I have to answer fast on those questions. They're like, how is that possible? You're really empathetic. I was like, I'm not naturally empathetic. I've honed this skill of empathy. I've improved, but it took practice. It took time, right? And I realized that for me, like my natural build could be really problematic because my top two strengths are strategic and competitive. So if you have somebody who is like driven and strategic and competitive, you can start to see people as tools and means to an end. But then I started to think like, hey, you know, the only way I can be successful is if I help other people to be successful through this process. And I have to think about myself, not just as a leader in general, but a conversational leader. So in my negotiations, I'm thinking of myself almost like a negotiation coach. I'm teaching people how they should act in a conversation. I'm using positive reinforcement and coaching them when they're good. And then I'm going to demonstrate that good behavior. So what I'm thinking is, listen, this is a tough conversation. I'm going to show them how to empathize. I'm going to show them how to care. I'm going to show them how to listen by doing those things first. And I'm going to walk them through it until they feel comfortable, right? And so it takes a lot of practice, but the mindset is where it has to start.
Now, it's a dance, right? We're dancing here, right? You know, sometimes you're leading, sometimes I'm leading. It's a vibe, right? You're kind of feeling them out. You have to be very, very present and emotionally in tune. But there is a tendency to want to go through this cycle in one sitting. My question is, how do we understand, or what feedback are we looking for from our dance partner in the negotiation to know, oh, they feel heard now. Now I could move into curiosity, because it's not just, oh, you told me, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, let's go on to the next thing, because now I'm curious, right? How do you, what are the cues, the feedback from your dance partner to say, yes, I'm ready to move on to phase two and allow you to be curious with me?
Yeah. So the two things we're going to look at are body language and tone. So there are going to be some signals with the body language that show attention. Now, let me tell you something. When it comes to reading body language, the most important thing for us to do is establish a baseline. What are you naturally like? So I can understand what a deviation from that body language is. And then when I see that deviation, I say, ah, something's off. I'm going to assume that's an emotional type of thing. Let's investigate, right? And then when I see your body language soften a little bit, when I see your tone calm down a little bit, your volume might go down, you're speaking a little bit slower, it makes me feel as though you're more in control. That's when I'm going to move and shift into the compassionate curiosity step number two, where I'm asking those open-ended questions. But sometimes the thing is, Elio, I'm not always right. They might still be emotional. They might be less emotional, but they might not be ready for number two. So I might ask a question and I still sense some emotionality. Oh, okay. I was a little bit premature. That's cool. I can float back to acknowledging and validating. And that's the thing about it. It flows. You have to flow with it, right? You're going to make those reads and then you'll know what to do. And the fact that it's only three steps helps you to feel a little bit more confident in knowing what to do. But you're right. You have to be able to get those reads, and tone and body language are the two things you need to focus on.
And it feels now in my mind, I had it as 1, 2, and 3. Now it's starting to feel more like a cycle, right? Where I could be going in one direction, flow back, go in that direction again, flow back. So I might be in 3 and then something triggers and we go back to 1 and we might be in 2, go back to 1, 2 to 3. And there's a dance happening all the time. You know, we go to lunch, we act like we weren't negotiating all morning. We come back in the afternoon, we dance again. Right. I'm starting to understand and get a feeling for how this is supposed to look. Now, I want to put this to you because as a lay person in negotiation, my automatic default of what a great negotiator is the person who wins. right? That is a great negotiator. Okay. So what is your definition of a great negotiator? And, you know, win could mean a lot of things, but I say I walked away with more chips than you did. Am I wrong about that?
Oh, 100%.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. But I will say that you can win every time with the right mindset. So this is how I define winning. So I say I'm winning in negotiation, or like I said, I define negotiation very broadly. So I'm winning in these conversations if two things are happening. Number one, I am putting myself in the best position to succeed. And number two, I'm getting better through the process. So if every time I have these conversations, I am doing the very, very best I can to put myself in the best position to succeed, and I'm taking the time to review my performance and say, okay, what did I do well? I want to do more of that. What did I do poorly? My goal is to not make the same mistake twice. So I'm incrementally getting better. So if I'm putting myself in the best position to succeed and constantly getting better with every single negotiation, then I will get what I'm supposed to get. And here's the thing about negotiation. I don't think about negotiation as the art of deal making. I think about negotiation as the art of deal discovery. You and me, we're sitting down, we're having a conversation to see whether or not a deal is to be had. Now, it might not be meant to happen. Sometimes the worst outcome is forcing a deal that should have never happened, right? And then to the point of like, who gets more, that's really arbitrary. It's really subjective too, because usually after a negotiation, people are like, oh man, you could have gotten 10K more. You know, we will never know. And that's one of the most unsatisfying parts of negotiation, but it's real. And the thing is though, I get more the more I'm able to help the other person, just by the norm of reciprocity, right? And I'll go back to Bob Wolf, who was the sports agent for Larry Bird. One of the things he would say is that every single time I negotiate, I try to leave 10% of value that I know I could have claimed on the table. He's like, I know I could have gotten 10% more, but I'm not going to, because this is a long-term game. I'm going to have multiple interactions with this person. And if I'm just cleaning everybody's clock every time, there's going to be some bad mojo out there. People are going to come back and try to get me. So we want to think about it long-term value and focus on the relationship too.
Okay. You know, we value relationships here at 614 Startups, but man, listen, it's not my fault you can't negotiate, all right? It's not my fault that I'm better than you. No, I mean, that's a real question I'm about to ask, okay? Because this is where the whole the mismatch in negotiation experience really comes into play when it comes to founders and startups. Yes. Typically, you're negotiating with an investor. They negotiate this type of deal day in and day out. This is your first one. Now, what are the ethical implications here of somebody who is a negotiator and has the skills and in many instances has the power dynamics playing in their favor? What do you teach at the American Negotiation Institute about the ethics of negotiation, particularly when you have the power on your side and you have the experience and you know across from the table from you, you're negotiating against someone who has no way, like they don't even know where to start. What are the ethical things that you guys think about with your clients when it comes to negotiation?
Yeah, this is a great question, Elio, because when it comes to like the rules of negotiation, the ethical side, it gets really fluffy. And this is me speaking specifically as a lawyer too, because there is no law that protects you from somebody being deceptive in a negotiation. Like, it needs to be a very high bar for it to be like a material misrepresentation of fact to get to that point. And so I think one of the things that we have to remember is that it's your responsibility to protect yourself at all times, right? And so for me, as a negotiator, my ethical code, I need to figure out what that is so I can understand how to navigate these conversations. Different people draw lines differently, but this is the way that I say it. So for me, I want to pretend as though somebody is watching me. Like, would my parents be proud of the way that I'm negotiating? If they were to see how I was doing this, would they be proud of it? Would the other person, if they knew how I'm strategizing, let's say hypothetically, if they could see behind the scenes, how would they feel about this? Now, those are very nebulous. Those are fluffy. That's my line. And so my thing is, when I think about negotiation, my goal is to help people to make a good decision too. Of course, I have my goals, I have my intentions and everything like that. And sometimes they might be competitive, but at the end of the day, I want people to have the information that they need to know in order to make a good decision. I need to find some way to feel good about that. And so there have been times where I'm negotiating with somebody who is like, they're outgunned. You know, we have the leverage, they're new at this and everything like that. But I still remember, like, most likely this is going to be a repeat interaction. At some point, it is likely that they will become savvy enough to realize that, you know, I just took their lunch, right? In a way that they cannot respect going forward. And this is the most important thing. So let's say hypothetically, I know everybody who listens to this podcast is a good person, but maybe we got some evil people who stumbled in, right? So let's say, well, Kwame, I actually identify as an evil person. Why should I do this? Why should I care? Let me tell you what. Leverage and power shift with time. Those dynamics can and will shift. And we have to understand the psychology of vengeance. And so when it comes to these situations, when it comes to the psychology of vengeance, like the act of getting revenge on somebody floods your body with dopamine. Studies have demonstrated this. And so you might say, well, it's illogical for somebody to come at me in this type of way down the road because it doesn't serve them. Does not matter. The fact that they are hurting someone, that they feel hurt them, is enough to justify hurting everybody, including themselves, right? And so that's the thing. Even if you do not consider yourself a good person, you have to remember that you're not always in control of the power dynamics. And when that leverage shifts, you want to have some trust, some goodwill, some rapport in place to protect you when the power alone cannot protect you.
All right, y'all. We spent a lot of time on step one. We touched on step two, but if you want two and three and four, you're going to have to buy a book. You're going to have to call the American Negotiation Institute, and Kwame will be happy to give you a consultation and talk to you about how you become a better negotiator, because we have much more to talk about on this podcast. We can't make you a full-fledged negotiator here, all right? So, Kwame, I want to quickly pivot to talking about why you decided to write. Why did you want to become an author? And then why did you choose? I mean, I have some insight now that we've been speaking over the last half hour or so, but why did you want to choose to tackle the issues of race and conflict?
Yeah. And so with writing, when it comes to writing books, it is, in my opinion, like the best way to get all of your ideas out in a clear and concise manner, right? If you want somebody's complete thoughts on what it is on a specific issue, a book is the best way to get it through. And something that I realized as I was writing, I didn't realize this before I became an author, but it really hones your skills. Like, writing makes you better at your craft. And there is a level of specificity that's required in writing that is not required with just oral tradition. So we can talk, we can freestyle and chat and everything like this. And I know people are listening to this and they're going to get a lot of information and really high quality information. But then if we were to look at this transcript, somebody who's like an expert, like editor, would say, you know what, Kwame, when you were talking, you went from A to C, you missed B. Okay, cool. Let me add that. And then we go A, B, C. And then you say, you know what, I thought it was A, B, C, but there are actually three more layers that we should have put in. So it forces you to go so much deeper. So that's one of the benefits. And so my first book, like I said, is Finding Confidence in Conflict. The second book is How to Have Difficult Conversations About Race. I named it that because I didn't know what else to call it. So that's just what it does. And so for me, I want to be where the hardest conversations are, Elio. I want to be where the toughest conversations are. And in 2020, it was the conversation about race. Everybody was struggling with that conversation. And the way that I think about it is, if you're able to comport yourself with dignity and respect and handle the emotionality and everything and the tumultuous nature of these conversations and handle conversations about race, sticking to the frameworks and the skills and tactics that I give in the book, then you can handle any conversation. Every other conversation is going to feel a lot easier if you can handle yourself in a conversation about race. So that was my thought process behind that. I want to be able to create content that helps people where they need it the most.
Yeah, man. Well, the fact that the book title, Having Difficult Conversations About Race, was even still available after 400-year history tells you how much people don't want to touch it, right? It was just there for you to name your book that because people just don't want to touch it in America. Now, I want to, it's such an issue that this question is the question that I came up with when I was thinking about this conversation, which is, then what do people get wrong when they try to talk about race versus the approach that you proffer in the book as a framework for talking about race? What do people get wrong now?
First thing is that they don't have the conversation when they should, right? They let the fear take over. So they're afraid of being misunderstood. They're being afraid of being labeled a racist, getting canceled, being ostracized for their beliefs. They're afraid of hurting people's feelings. And so they say, you know what? The risks are very clear. The rewards are not as clear, and I don't see a clear path toward the reward. So I'm just going to opt not to have the conversation. It seems like the safest decision. And honestly, now, if we're thinking about it rationally.
You're saying a white person now
has
these feelings. Okay. Oh, so everybody. This is universal. This feeling of I might get canceled. This feeling I might be ostracized. It's a feeling for anybody. Okay.
Everybody. I just wanted to be clear. So think of, No, great question too, right? I think the cancellation fear is more of a white thing, but think about a black person in a workplace, right? You might be one of very few, right? Or maybe the only one. You see something problematic. I stand out enough. I don't want to ruffle feathers and risk this. I got a good thing here, right? And so there's a legitimate fear. Maybe I offend my boss and then they fire me. Now I don't have an income. And so there are legitimate fears that hold us back. Like that fear of that leads us to not have the conversation, that's the biggest barrier. Then when we actually have the conversation, we make the mistake of thinking that facts, logic, and reasoning will be enough to win the day. We think that being right would be enough. Coming with our morals and saying what is right and wrong will be enough. And it is a really scary and frustrating place to be when you realize your facts don't work. And we've all been in those conversations. I did my research. I brought this to the conversation. I'm well-researched. And then somebody says, no, I don't agree with you. Based on what? And then we blow up. And now things get really frustrating. And so we need to be able to manage the emotions in these conversations. And the conversations about race are going to be more emotional. And any sensitive issue, especially if it's identity related, are going to be more emotional for two main reasons. Number one, morality, what it means to be a good or bad person. And then identity, what does it mean for a person like me to be in this situation? What does a person like me think? Well, how does a person like me feel? What does a person like me do? Right. And when those things are challenged, then that leads to a heightened level of emotionality. And that's why you see so much defensiveness in these conversations. We can't even have a true conversation because people are too busy protecting who they are, their identity, and then who they are as a good person, their morality. And if we can't understand where that emotionality comes from, and if we don't have a framework to address the emotionality in these conversations, we're pretty much doomed to failure.
Let's talk about assumptions or stereotypes and how they inform conversations around race. Just because somebody looks a certain way, that they are, it frames the way you even approach the conversation with them. What are, in your conversations, in your research for the book, what role does assumption, like the biases that you even bring to the conversation when you're talking with somebody you perceive in one way or the other?
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on bias and psychology of this, and also the assumptions too. We assume people think certain ways or believe certain things because of what they look like. But I think people would be shocked to know the races of some of the people that, like, of the conversations that I have outlined in the book. So there, like, throughout the book, there are all these examples of, like, how the conversation could happen, how it could happen when it's going well, how it could happen when it's going wrong. And outlining that, I think people would be pretty surprised because, you know, it doesn't, your race will inform your lived experience, but it doesn't, you're not destined to believe certain types of things. And so when we think about bias and the way that the brain works, it's really fascinating, scary, but also fascinating how this works. So for example, I give a story, I tell a talk about a study in the book where we have these participants who are tasked with giving a taste test for some wine, but they do it in an MRI scanner so we can see the brain activity. So cool. So taste this wine, and this wine is expensive. Here's the price point. Taste it. Tell me what you think. And now taste this wine. This wine is cheap. Taste it and tell me what you think. And they say, oh, this expensive wine, it tastes better. And then you look at the brain scan and you see actually more activity in the brain as they taste that wine. So their subjective interpretation matches what is happening beneath the surface in the scan. What they don't know is that it's the same wine, but because they believed it was more expensive, it actually changed in a real sense the way that they experienced the wine, right? And so we have to remember, as we're having these conversations with people, our biases, our perspectives, they're going to twist the reality of what's really happening. And so when we're thinking about our approaches to these conversations, we have to remember that we might be walking around in like the same place, observing the same things, while at the same time living in very, very different worlds. And once we start to appreciate just how powerful the psychology is, that's when we start to realize, oh, this is not just about data. This is not just about right and wrong. There's a lot more happening here, and we have to have more nuanced tools to address those things.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I am my perception, not even correct, because everybody has their perception of these two things. But I want to put this in stark contrast because it has a lot to do with how we approach inequity, at least in the startup world. We know what the data is in terms of funds raised, but I want to take it from a different direction. So you see the issue of like investor bias, right? So The default reaction is, well, these things exist because these biases exist. And when you look at me, you get that cheap wine, expensive wine experience. Versus when you look at somebody else, right? So you're judging me probably like you're not going to be able to handle the ups and downs of what it takes to build a startup. And so you're a little bit more risky. But man, this wine over here is tested and tried. I'm going to put my money with this wine, right? Psychologically. But I want to take it from a different, yep. I think that has been not exhausted, but that is a comment, that conversation.
Yeah.
The other conversation, that I want to have is the reaction to affirmative action, which was very visceral and is still argued today. And what is DE&I? Because I don't think that reaction is equally visceral, right? Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that? Because I feel like the initiatives that are couched as DE&I in terms of dealing with the issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion are not as visceral. However, there are still feelings about these programs and what they actually mean. And so how do you think race plays into our approach as founders and investors with dealing with the issues of inequity when it comes to funds that are raised and the programming that is now being designed around diversity, equity, and inclusion? I know that was a long question, but the preamble, yeah, I think maybe sets us up for what we need to talk about.
Absolutely. So let's talk about affirmative action first, right? And so when people talk about, make arguments in favor of affirmative action, they use fairness oftentimes. When people make arguments against affirmative action, they use fairness. A lot of times. And so as you start to dig into it, you start to realize that the word fair, it means very different things to different people. And so whenever I'm doing trainings, somebody says the word fair, I'm like, oh, we got the F word. I wondered how long it would take for us to realize that. And we think about fairness in terms of an objective reality, but it's still very subjective. And so what we think about this, Elio, if we're watching a sporting engagement, right, a sporting event, you know, there's one thing that you never hear the winners do. The winners never complain about the refs. I won. Why would I complain about the refs? If I don't see if things are going well for me, then it is in my best interest to assume that everything was fine, right? And so there's a lot of confirmation bias that goes into it. Because if I start to think that this was inequitable or unfair, then I think it calls into question where I stand too. And so it's a threat to who I am, my identity, not just about the objective reality of inequity. No. This is about like who I am as a person. That is the true threat, right? And so that is really a lot. That's where the visceral reaction toward affirmative action comes from, because people will talk about it in terms of fairness, but really a lot of times it's about identity, because it calls into question the validity of their own accomplishments. So that's where it is with the affirmative action. Now, with diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think what was done with that movement was that it was strategically designed in a way that makes it a little bit more palatable, right? So diversity, okay, that seems a little bit less threatening. So it's not just a binary choice, you versus me. It's all of us together. Inclusion, again, we all are included. Yep, go ahead.
Got to interrupt you on this, because the thought just came to me and I don't want to lose it.
Go ahead.
That diversity was not necessarily about the makeup of the company. It was couched in the, we need to reflect the communities that we serve. Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. It's not about the staffing ratios. When I look out and I see the customers we serve, it kind of makes sense. I just wanted to make that point in terms of how some of these things were looked at differently to produce a different result.
Absolutely. But it, to that point, Elio, it speaks to the strategic nature of the semantics of the argument, right? Because if we can think about it in terms of how we win together, it's kind of like what we're talking about in the last segment, the win-win, I can see value in it. It's less threatening. Now, people are going to listen to this and they'll say, well, Kwame, I mean, this is kind of ridiculous, because it's about right and wrong. It's about doing the right thing. It's about addressing structural inequities that have existed for 400 years, right? That's what it's about. And I shouldn't have to coddle the emotions of people with privilege in order for the right thing to happen, right? And to that, I say, you make a good point. And at the same time, we have to recognize that we live in a world that is bound by the laws of psychology here, right? The things that person says, they're legitimate complaints. And again, like I said, it's not that what I'm saying, like the strategies and skills and tools that I'm talking about, are hard to understand. They're difficult to execute, because you will not want to. You might not feel as though the person deserves your empathy, or you might not feel as though you should have to approach it in a way that makes them feel a little bit more willing to move towards you. And for me, and I think I have a bit of a benefit because I was a lawyer. And so for me, I can't say, let me go into a negotiation and the person offends me, and then I just like insult them, just let them have it, like lay into them, and then go back to my client. I'm like, man, you should have seen me in that negotiation. I crushed them, hit them with the 1-2. And they're like, cool, Kwame. Well, did we get the deal? I'm like, no, man, they hate us. But I let them have it. I let them know, right? For me, I have to be outcome oriented. And so I will use whatever tool, a tactic, and strategy gets me to the outcome that I'm looking for. And if my outcome that I'm looking for is equity, is fairness, is justice, those type of things, I have to realize that a lot of times in the process of achieving those things, I have to sacrifice what would make me feel good in the moment, which might be lashing out, in order to meet the objective.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, we got to take a break. I hate to do this, but we have to take a break, people. I could talk to him about this all day. All right. Thank you guys so much for hanging in there. We're going to take our final break, and then we'll be back for a final word from Kwame. Hang in there. Support for the 614 Startups podcast comes from Book and Street. Book and Street provides finance and accounting solutions for startups in the Midwest and beyond. From strategic financial support to bookkeeping and everything in between, they've got your back office covered. Let their experienced team of finance and accounting professionals help your startup get it right from the start. Learn more at bookandstreet.com and set up your free 30-minute consultation with their team today. Today's episode is sponsored by the City of Dublin's Division of Economic Development. The City of Dublin provides world-class, tailored business services and resources to ensure the best possible environment for businesses to recruit talent and thrive. Because of this strategic focus and commitment to employer growth, Dublin is the only accredited economic development organization in the state of Ohio. The City of Dublin supports startups and entrepreneurs by offering targeted resources and training programs to grow companies that are financially sustainable, innovative, and committed to creating jobs. Learn how other businesses depend on Dublin. Visit thriveindublinohio.com. 614 Startups Nation, thank you again for joining us. I am continuing my conversation with Kwame Christian of the American Negotiation Institute. We're back for our final segment. We've talked a lot about what you do in terms of the service that you provide, but now I want to talk about what you do as a founder, as a business owner. So the American Negotiation Institute, we know what you do, but what is the experience of being an entrepreneur? What are some lessons that you've learned along the way starting this company and getting the company? I see you already smiling and laughing. What are some of the lessons that brought you to where you are today?
The first lesson that I've learned is that everything is harder than I thought it was going to be. You know, starting a podcast was harder than I thought. Generating consistent revenue was harder than I thought. Managing a team is harder than I thought. And then I also had this, it's funny to say it now. I had this idea that like at a certain level, it would start to get easy. Like things would start to coast and things like that. It's like, okay, cool. I got to a certain level. I hit that magic number. This is great. I'm good. Right. And then things got harder, Elio. I was like, this is not what I anticipated. And so I think the surprise of the difficulty was at the time, I'll say disheartening. But now with a new mindset, I think it's really encouraging because it makes what I do harder to replicate. You know, so I'm in a very narrow niche here with negotiation and conflict resolution. And I know how hard it was for me to get to this point. I know how hard it was for me to grow this audience with a podcast and everything like that. And so now I look at those challenges and I really embrace them and truly appreciate them because it helps us to stand out. So now we have the top ranked negotiation podcast in the world. We're on the LinkedIn Podcast Network, one of less than 10 that got that invite. And, we're at a point where our downloads have grown significantly. We're at about 370,000 downloads per month at this point. And so it's going to be significant by the end of the year. And it's just continuing to grow. And it's been really exciting to see that growth, see the adoptions, see the companies we get to serve, like Google, Apple, NASA, Target, we've got some big name clients now. And it's just really exciting. And I'm just embracing the challenge. And I think that's one of the biggest surprises, just how challenging it is. And now the fact that I enjoy the challenges more.
Yeah, now you listed some big names there. What is it like selling into those big names, right? So you're American Negotiation Institute, you have a team behind you, but there's a whole sales process into selling into a large corporate like that. What was your experience like? How did you approach it? How did you get that first person to talk to even get to the point where you have these companies as clients?
Yeah, man, it's tough. And it takes a lot of patience too, especially a lot of our clients are in procurement too. And so we're negotiating with expert negotiators to teach them negotiation. it's very meta, you know, and then
they have to test you because they have to see how good you are. Yeah.
Yeah. And we know we're being tested too. Right. And so it's like, okay, come like, I would just like to close this deal, but okay, I'll show you what we got. You know, we're tough enough, you know? And so it takes a lot of patience because when you're a Fortune 5 company like Apple, you could take a long time there. You're not in a rush, but when you're a small business, you have to make payroll every month. You're like, hey, now, come on now. Why are you slow rolling this? Net 60? What's 60? Really? Why? Right. And so you have to get enough cash flow to make sure that you can survive in order to have the luxury of negotiating at a higher level. Because great negotiation takes time in a lot of situations, but cash flow works on a different type of timeline, cash flow and payroll, those type of things too. So with more success, we're able to flex the negotiation skills that we knew we had, but we just didn't have the privilege to execute upon, you know? So that was another interesting challenge too, as we grew.
Yeah. And you haven't lived unless you've had a Fortune 500 company make you wait 60 days to pay an invoice. You have not lived the anticipation, the edge of your seat, right? That is the roller coaster of business. And I'm glad that you acknowledge that. So I want to chat with you about what's next.
Yeah,
you're starting to build your roster of great clients and hopefully forming long-term partnerships. So what's next for you?
Yeah, so what's next is focusing on scalability, right? Because it's been fun doing all of this travel. I'm on a plane almost every single week. I'm mastering that 24-hour turnaround. Last week, I was in Vegas for less than 24 hours, which is it sounds ridiculous, right? But that's what I do. Get on a plane, do these trips and everything like that. And it's fun. I enjoy it. But I have a young family, you know, so for me, being on a plane like every week, I'm still doing a good job of being able to say, all right, I've got a presentation on Wednesday. I'm going to fly out late Tuesday, come back as soon as I can on Wednesday so I don't miss a day with my family. But I can't. We do not have space for more events. That's just the reality. So we're going to scale focusing on course creation, but also building into a learning management system where our clients can get access to an ever-increasing library of high-level negotiation content. That's real focus. But in order to be able to do that at a high level, we need to keep on growing the audience. We're going to start to expand into YouTube and things like that. And it's just, again, the LinkedIn Podcast Network deal gives us an opportunity to grow more comfortably, because that deal should be at a place depending on where the downloads end up for this year, like the LinkedIn Podcast Network deal should be enough to pay payroll for everybody for the entirety of the year. That gives us a lot of flexibility to build out courses, be more aggressive in other areas as well. So scalability, that's really the key, because I cannot afford to be on a plane more because the opportunity cost of family time is way too great.
Yeah, big shout out to Las Vegas. But if there's ever a city where a 24-hour turnaround time should be mandated, it might be Vegas. All right, Kwame, let's hear a final word from you, man. How do people get a hold of you, book you for speaking engagements, buy your book, or work with the American Negotiation Institute?
Yeah, so check out AmericanNegotiationInstitute.com. That's the central repository for everything. You'll get access to all of our online course when that is ready. You'll see where you can get access to the podcast, Negotiate Anything. We're at 7 days a week now, which is crazy to think about. And then, yeah, if you're interested in working with us, reach out. My goal is to get more to get more local gigs. It's like that joke where they say you can't be famous in your own town. I need to get more Columbus gigs, more Central Ohio gigs. Like, that's really one of my focuses, grow more intentionally locally, because we've got the majority of our listeners are abroad in different countries, all around the U.S. too. So I want to stay home a little bit more in 2023.
All right, you heard him. Let's prove that cliche wrong, and let's get the American Negotiation Institute more gigs right here in the capital city. I think we could all stand to be better negotiators. So Kwame, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast, man. Great conversation. I think a part two is definitely in order. We could go a lot deeper than we have already. And if I could take you up on B-School, man, we could definitely do some negotiation role play. All right, folks, you've been listening to my very special guest, Kwame Christian of the American Negotiation Institute. Thank you so much for being part of the 614 Startups family. And until next time, peace. That's a wrap, folks. You can find this and all our episodes on our website, 614startups.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and all your favorite podcasting platforms. Don't forget to subscribe and write a review. If you'd like updates sent directly to your inbox, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter on the website. To engage in the 614 Startups community, follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at 614 Startups on all platforms and join the conversation. For sponsorship opportunities and collaborations, email us at info@614startups.com.